This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Think African-American cooking, and you may think soul food. There is that, and a whole lot more, and so much history. Sailing ships and Africans in chains brought seeds and foods and food traditions. Black chefs and families and chuckwagon cooks and Pullman porters helped spread them across the country. Now there's a little soul food, sometimes a lot, in a whole lot of American meals. This hour On Point, an African-American culinary history and some great food on the table. You can join the conversation, Can You See, Taste, the Trace Lines of This Past at Your Family's Kitchen Table. What's your greatest soul food specialty? Our greatest culinary gift from Africa. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New Orleans is Jessica Harris, culinary historian and the author of many best-selling books and cookbooks, scholar-in-residence at Dillard University in New Orleans. Brett Anderson in the New Orleans Times-Picayune calls her the country's foremost authority on the cuisine of the African diaspora. Her new book is High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. Jessica Harris, welcome. It's great to have you with us from New Orleans.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. And we know from Brett Anderson at the Times-Picayune that you get around and you do some good eating there. He writes in the Times-Picayune, it seems like every other time I go to Dookie Chay's for lunch, Harris is there spooning into a bowl of gumbo. Has he got you right, Jessica?
Well, he's got me right, but he's got me wrong on one order. Okay. I am no longer the scholar in residence at Dillard. I consult with Dillard, but I am back at Queens College where I have been for 40-some-odd years.
Back there and back all over Africa for years and years now, looking at the markets and the foods there, tracing them here right over to the United States. You have written so much about this cuisine, you know, big books, Beyond Gumbo, The Welcome Table, African American Heritage Cooking, Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons, Africa's Gift to New World Cook, gifts, I should say, to New World Cooking. After all that, what are you up to in High on the Hog, Jessica?
Well, High on the Hog is kind of interesting in the sense that it is not a cookbook. It really is a narrative history in another kind of way. One of the things that's been interesting about my journey vis-a-vis the cookbooks is that there's always been this sort of underlying thread of, oh my goodness, that's such a great story. I wish I could say more, but you're doing recipe in cookbooks.
The story behind the recipes, in other words.
Precisely.
The story behind the food.
So absolutely. That's the thing that's so much fun is not only the stories about where the ingredients may have come from or how the recipes may have developed, but the people. I find the people absolutely fascinating.
Your dedication here has got a bunch of parts to it, but right in the middle, it's to the ancestors who slaved, served, survived, and created a cuisine from a sow's ear to those past who used that food to nourish families, grow fortunes, and connect communities. That's a moving kind of dedication. Begin to take us into it. Where does your journey, your story of this cuisine begin?
Well, I think one of the things that happens is that as far as the book goes, and ultimately perhaps my own culinary journey, started with an epiphany in Dakar, Senegal, actually. Mm-hmm. Years ago, before Roots, I was working on my doctoral
Haley,
dissertation.
Yeah, way back.
Yeah, before Alex Haley and Roots. I was working on my doctoral dissertation, and it was on the French-speaking theater of Senegal. So I made my first trip to Western Africa. And at that time, I was also working at Essence magazine as travel editor, and I kept tasting things. And things tasted like dishes that I'd had maybe a month prior in another country or even earlier in my own existence at my grandmother's tables. And I kept trying to make these connections. And that was pretty much where the journey began, with the making of connections.
Could you just lay out for us some of the very factual, direct connections, foods that we now eat and enjoy here that have direct connections to Africa, and how those, and what those connections are, where they trace back to?
Well, one of the things that I find fascinating is so many of the things that are kind of psychically connected with African Americans, if you will, in the American psyche, actually do originate on the African continent. Okra.
Love okra. Can't get enough okra.
Well, you must be a Southerner at heart, or an African American.
I've got some in the family tree. Definitely.
There you go. But I mean, I think one of the things that happens with that is this lovely, and here's my favorite word for okra, mucilaginous pod. You know, that slime,
you have to love
the thing
it to get
that
past
everybody
that.
Hates. Right. You know. Unless they know how to use it.
Yeah.
The bottom line with okra is don't fight the slime. Now, okra is relative. I've always thought of this as being one of the great culinary ironies. Okra is a relative of cotton, botanically.
Cotton.
And so the people who were brought in many ways, not necessarily, but who often chopped the cotton were also responsible for the okra. So there's sort of this botanical kinship. Okra is one of them.
And the word itself, well, from the Igbo language of Nigeria, you tell us.
Exactly. Where it's something like okruru. And then you can find it's got a Ghanaian, Nkroma. And then when you get down to the Bantu languages, it becomes Ochingombo, Kingombo. And you can even see that Kingombo, Gingombo, in Hispanic languages in the New World, where you'll find okra is known as kimbombo.
And ochingombo and okra working their way into gumbo, and there's
into
a
gumbo,
full circle
precisely,
right into
down
American
here
cuisine.
In New Orleans where I'm speaking from.
Black-eyed peas, the way you describe it, all over Africa, and at the heart of what we think of is a lot of African-American cuisine in this country.
Absolutely, and certainly our New Year's black-eyed pea dish, which would be the Hoppin' John, which friends around the world have written to tell me, hey, we are of African descent and we too eat a pea with rice at New Year's. So that makes us begin to think about the Rio Pois Congo, the Congo peas or Gunga peas and rice that they eat in the Caribbean, all along with our Hoppin' John, our black-eyed peas and rice. Here are two surprises, I think, for people. Well, first of all, let me go to watermelon and some of the most virulently anti-black images of that post-Reconstruction era.
Wonderful fruit turned into a kind of a taunt, that fantastic thing to eat.
Well, yeah. But if you think about it, the great thing about watermelon is it's a high percentage of water. And if people are in an area where they don't know about the cleanliness of the water or they don't have access to water, watermelon is perfect. It also replenishes nutrients, great for people who worked in the hot sun from dawn to dusk.
Sure.
All of those things that were positives about watermelon, you know, got sort of subsumed under this negative imagery. Now, here are two surprises. Sesame, which I always connected mentally with Asia. I mean, I thought of sesame chicken and all of those sesame sauces, but it's an oil seed that has its origin on the African continent. And so the whole notion of sesame oils, and in South Carolina, in Charleston particularly, they keep the Wolof name, Wolof being one of the languages of Senegal, and the Wolof name for sesame is Benny, as in Benny seed wafers, and you can't go to Charleston without seeing them. They're sold in the supermarkets, they're sold on the streets, they're sold at the airport. Charleston's Benny seed wafers, which bring us the Wolof word for sesame.
So all of these African, oh, you got one more on this list of African origin?
Yeah.
Good, let's hear it.
Okay, what did you have a cup of this morning?
Well, I had a cup of coffee.
There you go. Ethiopian Highlands, where coffee originated.
Well, that's a pretty strong lineup, at least in my book. But even, I mean, just with sesame, okra, watermelon, black-eyed peas, I see sorghum making it onto some of these lists of African origin foods. I see yams, different from sweet potato, but real straight-up yams. I was also fascinated by the way the New World foods actually cycled back and got African names themselves, or at least nicknames, come to goober. Who would have thunk? It goes back to the African continent.
Right, exactly. That word nguba, meaning peanut. But there was also a sort of an antecedent, if you will. It's called the Bambara groundnut. It's a different genus and species. It is another legume, but it was used very much as the peanut. And so once the peanut got to the African continent, in many cases, it took over where the Bambara groundnut left off. In fact, the Bambara groundnut was known as ngerte, and that is now, again, the Wolof word for those peanuts.
We're going to take a short break soon. We're going to come back and dig into some of the great dishes. You do have, 20 or so recipes at the back of your book.
I said 20. Somebody counted them and said 23.
Okay,
so, yes.
That's fine. 23. But I guess your point here is in part to give us the journey that these foods have taken, but it's also about a kind of integration of this continent's traditions through sometimes bitter and sometimes wonderful experience into this whole country's cuisine.
Exactly. I think that's one of the things that's amazing.
And in a way, the Africanization of the southern palate and then the whole palate of this country.
Well, a wonderful historian named Eugene Genovese gave me a quote that I just delight in using, where he talks about the culinary despotism of the slave cabin over the big house. So I think that when we think of that, when you think of, in many cases, certainly in the South, and we tend to balkanize the whole history of enslavement in this country, South and North, there were slaves in the North. There were slaves in New York. There were slaves in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
There were slaves throughout the 13 colonies. No signer of the Declaration of Independence lived in a zone where slavery was not the law. And when you think of that breadth of people, you begin to think about just how vast and how much a part of the American ethos, and certainly the culinary ethos, this African hand in the pot was.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about soul food and much more, the roots of African-American food, of a whole lot of now American food. Jessica Harris joins us from New Orleans. She's the author of the new book, High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. And it is a really terrific story. You can see an excerpt of her book at our website, onpointradio.org. Jessica Harris in New Orleans, and we are very lucky to have, and boy, the studio is full of the wonderful aroma of it right now, Tony Brooks with us, joining me in the studio. He's the chef and owner of Coast Cafe. Coast Cafe, it's a wonderful soul food and more restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right across the river. He's been good enough to bring in some great samples of African-American cuisine, which we'll be lucky enough to taste in just a second. Tony Brooks, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It was great of you to open up Jessica's book, High on the Hog, dip into some of those 23 recipes at the back, and bring some out of there. What have we got on the table here? Jessica, first I should say, Jessica, Tony, Jessica.
How are you?
Nice to meet you, Ms. Harris.
Jessica, Tony's been he's been playing in your recipes. What have you got here, Tony?
I have fried chicken, a little summer succotash.
Beautiful.
And we have the collard greens.
Oh, they look and smell fantastic. We're going to dip into those in just a moment. Was it all familiar to you, Tony, what you found in Jessica's recipes at the back of the book?
It sure was. You know, like any family, everyone has their little twist to it, but sure. It's, the generalistics are pretty much the same. Yeah.
And what about the stories themselves in this book of the foods that the plants and foods that actually came over from Africa, of how they got integrated into American eating? Is that all familiar as well? Is that on your mind when you're in your kitchen whipping up the evening's offerings?
Oh, yes. Being with friends and family and just experiencing different events, Everyone has their little twists, and it's interesting to see how people do different things, and the tastes are a little different, but they're all pretty much the same recipe.
We're going to put the spoon in just a moment and enjoy some of this. Jessica, Tony, listen to for just a minute with us here, a pretty famous voice. This is March last year. President Obama made a surprise stop at Mrs. Wilkes' Dining Room. It's a restaurant well known in downtown Savannah for plates of fried chicken, pulled pork, and cornbread, and bowls of baked beans, sweet potatoes, cream corn, and collard greens. He washed it down with sweet tea, and this was his aside.
Can I just say to the press, I don't want any lectures about my cholesterol today. All right? Don't tell Michelle.
Don't tell Michelle. Now, he's lean enough, he can get away with it. But Jessica Harris, first of all, what about that menu that the president sat down to there in Savannah? And what about, you know, give me a break on the cholesterol side. Don't tell Michelle. I don't know, what makes your soul food menu? What counts? Is all that soul food? And what about, you know, these days people think, oh, I don't know, is that going to be healthy for me?
Okay, well, you've given me a couple of things. First of all, I tend to rant about the term soul food. You've used it frequently.
Rant on. We're all ears.
People sort of who are watching me cringe every time it's mentioned. Because I think what it does is it trivializes African-American food in many ways. Mrs. Wilkes is not an African-American restaurant, mm-hmm. to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so what he's eating there is Southern food. Mm-hmm. And I think as Southern food, you've got more of a scope. I think when we start talking about the food of African-Americans, yes, there is certainly that soul food component that Tony has talked about, that thing that becomes celebratory. But this is the food that comes out of enslavement. It is the those ancestors who basically really did make, if not a silk purse, something pretty darn special out mm-hmm. of a sow's ear.
That is not much to work with.
Well, not much to work with. Well, it depends.
It turned out to be a lot.
When you see what they've made
right,
out of it, it's
right,
pretty good.
Right,
you know?
No kidding.
That's why chitlins are so expensive
yeah,
nowadays.
That's right.
But, you know, one of the things that happens is that's one side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
There are other sides. It's sort of like the blind man and the elephant or Rashomon. There are many different ways of telling the tale. The entrepreneurship. Tony is the chef owner.
Yes,
of the
is.
Coast Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Food has allowed generations of people of African descent, and I am assuming Tony is, because there is no way to know.
He's giving you a little nod there.
Yes.
okay, but that there's no way to know, and there's no way to know necessarily even mm-hmm. in the kitchen, mm-hmm. hence the Mrs. Wilkes.
Mm-hmm.
But my point being that generations of people of African descent have raised families, put kids through college to become, if not chefs, doctors, lawyers, mm-hmm. arguably Indian chiefs, using food as a means of, you know, economic growth. There's also a diversity. I mean, for years, people of African descent, African Americans, have cooked in the houses of others, and they have cooked those dishes of others, but all the time adding what the Chinese refer to as that wok hand, the hand of the chef in the pot that always transforms the dish. I know that Tony has cooked, theoretically, my recipes,
mm-hmm.
but in cooking them, he has made them his. And that's what happened, and that's part of the history.
You can't touch it, Tony, without making it your own in some way.
Well, precisely.
It's so funny. My mother always told me that, you know, we're going to take your parents or your grandparents' recipes, and you're going to make your little twist to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone, through generations,
that's
everyone
living.
Does that, and that's what it's all about. But in essence, it still comes from way back.
Jessica, you know? Paint the picture of how this cuisine, this food, these foods, but ultimately their expression of these foods came to this continent and got integrated into the bigger American palate. Now, we know the chains and slave ships are a substantial part of that story, but as you describe it, that is not the whole story.
No, that's not the whole story. And I think one of the things that we forget, first of all, I am increasingly fascinated by the history of enslavement in this country, because I am of an age where it was presented at school as a very black-white North-South thing,
mm-hmm.
and it is not. there are so many distinctions and gradations and variations and permutations that it's really hard to make a generalization of one sort or another. But what we find is, equally, the slave traders knew much more about certainly the western coast of Africa and the civilizations that lived there than we, for the most part, do today.
Mm-hmm.
They sailed their ships in time to make harvests. They knew what people ate and what they wouldn't eat, because the power of no was a mighty power. It was probably one of the few powers that the enslaved could exercise. No, I won't eat that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in learning all of these things, they too played a role in bringing these foodstuffs from the African continent to the United States, and in fact to the hemisphere. So we'll see things like rice. Africa has its own rice, its own native rice, Oryza glabirima, which is different from the sativa that is the rice that is grown in China and in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew? But this rice, its method of growing, its way of growing, was not only traditional to certainly the southern Senegambia, that area of Western Africa that's known as the grain coast, Senegal, Guinea, you know, arguably Liberia, Sierra Leone, those areas grew their own rice, had their own methodology, and slave traders knew that. Hence that famous poster of a South Carolina slave auction where it talks about slaves from, or Africans from, the rice coast who knew how to grow rice. So not only did they get people who had particular skills, they knew what those skills were.
And once these enslaved Africans and the shipmasters and the foods made it to this continent, how did the cuisines develop? You know, how much was in the enslaved quarters, how much was in the big house, and then the meeting of the two, how did that unfold?
Well, I think there's much of the meeting of the two. You know, I always sort of, if I'm lecturing, like to say, you know, when people got off the boat, they were immediately initiated into what I like to call the nitty-gritty end of the food chain. I mean, people grew it, they processed it, they cooked it, they served it, and if you really want to get basic about it, they emptied the chamber pots.
Sure, they did everything.
It doesn't get any more full circle in terms of being connected to the food of people than that.
When you look at what some call soul food, you won't want to, but that menu that people know, how much of that is directly up out of the African legacy, and how much of it is the kind of hybridizing with the foods and the cuisines that they found, that they worked their way into on this continent?
I think one of the things that they found, and one of the things with the sort of hybridizing of this legacy, is that that it was all about a certain kind of adaptation and ebb and flow. It was really very, you know, I mean, when you think about the slave cabins, they were the slave cabins. There was the slave row. There were these places, unspeakable in many cases, where people lived. And there were multiple different ways of dealing with provisioning the enslaved. On some of the earlier plantations, people lived in barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And in living in the barracks, they were fed in the barracks as well. On other plantations, as you know, the process of enslavement got more, for want of a better term, refined or fine-tuned, you find the development of the slave houses, the slave streets, the slave quarters that are more our mental picture currently.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, the enslaved were given provision grounds in many cases. It was more perhaps of a Caribbean methodology, but they were given a plot of land to plant and grow, and as they planted and grew things that they preferred, things that they wanted to eat. And in some cases, there are records of slave owners making sure to buy certain kinds of seeds, pepper seeds. And then when I say peppers, I mean chilies.
Mm-hmm.
Things of that would have responded to prevalent African and Africanized tastes that then were grown by the individuals on their provision lands. And one of the things that to me was extraordinarily poignant was reading how people who had worked and toiled and labored for others all day, you know, dawn to dusk mm-hmm. and beyond, what is the thing, from can to can,
yeah,
would then raise their own things by the light of, and this was what was so poignant, tallow with a wick in a broken pot just to light the ground so that after dark, after bone tired, mm-hmm. they could plant for themselves.
And to bring it home and make that into a cuisine that would work its way into so much of what Americans eat these days. We've got lots of response here online, Jessica. First Dave says, you know, he's saying whoop whoop from Mama Dips in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Oh, yes, fried chickens,
okay.
Collards, and yams. Kevin, speaking to this, you know, sort of cross race line, certainly pleasure here, says, my mother, this is on Facebook, says, my mother cooked what New Yorkers called soul food, but to her, it was just the recipes her mother taught her, Southern cooking. And here's Gimli, says, I grew up in New Orleans where the Afro-Caribbean culinary tradition predominated. I thought that this was just plain old everyday food and that everyone in the country experienced near religious ecstasy at every meal. A little traveling dissuaded me of that notion. She's up in Boston after Katrina and looking around for it. She says, I don't think much of all the books and music and furniture, everything else I lost, but I frequently think of the fried catfish, po' boy, and R&O's seafood restaurant. Let's get some callers right here. Liberty, Kentucky. Kathy's calling. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air with Jessica Harris and Tony Brooks of the Coast Cafe.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up and returned to rural Kentucky, and around here it's overwhelmingly white. It's, I would say, 98% white in the last census. I moved to New Orleans in the early 90s, and when I got there, I was just overwhelmed with all the food, etouffee, gumbo, po'boys, remoulade, everything. I loved it. And my boss said, well, have you ever been to a soul food restaurant? And I said, no, I never had. You know, I was a country girl.
Yeah,
grew up
yeah.
there. And he said, well, let's go. And so when I got there and sat down, I was just shocked when I opened the menu because it was fried chicken and collard greens and cornbread and grits. And I was like, well, this is what I ate at home. So I had no idea that being a country kid, what we ate was actually soul food.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was an interesting little...
Absolutely, thing. Kathy, and I know exactly what you mean. I've got a little Kentucky in the family, and so much of this seems marvelously familiar to me as well. Jessica, how did that happen? She's in 98% white country, and then the food she grew up with tastes like soul food to her, whether or not you like that word.
Okay, don't forget, I mean, and certainly that sort of Appalachian spine of the South, if you will, was in many areas not necessarily slaveholding. So that whole monolithic, you know, this is slavery. However,
but there's the food.
Okay, remember, that's where I'm going. Yeah. I'm not forgetting that.
Yeah.
As recently as the 20th century, even in areas where there were no, or there were few blacks, those few blacks often worked in domestic work. They raised people. They fed people. But equally, you've got parallel trends. Some of this is po' folks' food. Some of this is good, solid country food. The seasonings may change. But, you know, we've rubbed up against each other culturally for so long that it's very difficult at times to say, oh, this is mine, that's yours. I mean, one of my least favorite caricatures of myself was of a fairly monumental battle royal that a gentleman named Damon Fowler and I had, and we're friends, and we were just sort of really kind of worrying things out the way historians do, and I guess food historians do as well. And the thing was a caricature of two people dueling with chicken legs. Fried chicken is mine, fried chicken is yours. He was operating or opting for the English Anglo-Saxon origins of fried chicken, and I, of course, was firmly standing my ground.
Everybody claims it.
There you go. But, I mean, everybody can claim it.
I want the frim-fram sauce with the awesome fee with chifafa on the side.
A fella's really got to eat, and a fella should eat right. 5 will get you 10. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said. Waiter, please serve mine fried. I want the frim fram sauce with the arsen fee, with shafafa on the side.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about soul food and much more with Jessica Harris, author of the new book, High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America, the great tale of how so much wonderful food and cuisine and tradition arrived at this country and worked its way right into the American culture. She joins us today from New Orleans. Tony Brooks is with us as well, chef and owner of the Coast Cafe in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he has filled the plate for me that looks wonderful. We will be right to it. Tony, you've been back in the recipes at the back of this book.
Yes.
And I've got, well, we've got succotash, we've got collard greens, and we've got some beautiful fried chicken here. Tell us about the, Jessica, maybe I'll come to you first. This succotash recipe, give us the kind of a roots treatment here. How does this end up on the American menu?
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, the classic succotash is a Native American dish.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that people tend to not look at all that much is this sort of wonderful thing that happens between Native Americans and African Americans. I called that the power of three. And I've always wondered about what I like to think of as perhaps a complicit smile when at the edge of some market somewhere,
mm-hmm,
an African newly arrived might have spied a Native American,
mm-hmm,
and recognized a kinship. I think that there are things that are fascinating in the communalities of our foodways, if you will, and I've been taken to task for using that term. But the idea of the whole notion of cooking over flame as opposed to cooking in a hearth, the idea of a taste for soured ingredients, that buttermilk thing that, mm-hmm, that happens on the African continent often, that idea of that long, slow, soupy stew that's simmered a long time. Those are communalities. Those are certainly culinary communalities that we don't find in the same ways in the European kitchen at that time. I think one of the things that's so fun about this succotash is, for me, it is something that you can cook, or I can cook, all year round.
Oh boy.
It's okra, corn, and tomatoes.
Yeah.
The classic succotash is lima beans and tomato. Lima beans and corn, rather. In some cases, people will add black-eyed peas to it. In some cases, they will add some kind of a smoked meat as a seasoning, usually a bit of bacon or fatback or something like that.
Okay, that's it. I can't resist anymore. I'm eating while you're talking.
Well, see, I'm just talking because you get to eat and I don't.
Sorry.
And I don't
be
think
jealous
that's
that
fair.
My fork is full, and here we go. And boy, is it gorgeous. Tony, talk to us about this recipe, this version of succotash. Oh, is that full and rich and wonderful?
Well, this is one version she has in the back of the book, and mm-hmm, it has the okra, the corn.
Mm-hmm.
We have the pepper, the habanero pepper that I put in for a little bit, for a little spice.
Yeah, just a little kick there, just a little nice kick.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great recipe. I've never had it with the corn, but it was good.
Very good. What would your straight-ahead succotash include, ingredient-wise?
Well, it was the tomatoes, the okra.
Lima beans, or in your case, or black-eyed peas?
Black-eyed peas, mm-hmm, sometimes, or the lima beans.
This has got a lighter feeling to it, maybe, than if it had more lima bean and black-eyed pea in it.
It would be a heavier, yes.
Very nice. And okra right in the middle of it. I mean,
right.
Jessica, you said early on, okra is kind of dividing line, but I don't know a whole lot of Southerners who don't just go with okra and love it. I certainly think it's fantastic, but I guess some people are like, whoa, what is that?
Yeah, well, people don't like its great mucilaginous properties. So, I mean, they'd fight the slime. And if you fight the slime, you got a problem with okra because it's going to do that.
Yeah.
But it's got great taste of earth. It's got that deep, deep, wonderful flavor to it. It's hard to get down there without a food like okra. It's so fantastic.
Well, I've got okra on my business card and my stationery. So you're preaching to the converted here.
Let's get our listeners in here, if I may. Excuse me.
Sure.
They've been waiting a long time, too.
Mila
in Providence, Rhode Island, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi,
Hi, Tom. Great program.
Thank you.
Long-time listener, and this is my first time getting through to you. I am originally from Gambia, West Africa.
Great.
And you are talking about something that I know a lot about, and I want to compliment the folk that you have in the program there, too, demonstrating a lot of knowledge about the cuisine back home. I was in Gambia. I just got back. I was there for a month, for the whole month of January. I just got back a week ago. And what is interesting is I would like for your guest to talk mm-hmm. about post-slavery. We are still bringing food from Africa. And what are the dynamics and the changes that are taking place from slavery to what is going on right now? I go on a regular basis. Every year I go on vacation to my native country of Gambia.
Yes.
And I bring food with me, plenty of it. And every day I eat one thing or another that is native of West Africa.
So you bring it back to the States after you've visited Gambia. I will put that to Jessica Harris, Miley, but may I ask you first, when you're in Gambia and thinking back to what passes for soul food or African-American origin food in this country, do they taste similar? Do you see the similarities in the menu or the table here and there?
Similar, but not the same, in the sense that what I eat down in Gambia are not frozen food, are fresh cut vegetables and harvested material.
Uh-huh. And the recipes themselves, what about there?
The recipes are the same. My wife is from Gambia, and she cooks it just as we would at home in Gambia.
Fantastic. Myla, thank you so much. Jessica Harris, what about that ongoing sort of communication of food between Africa and America today, post-slavery time?
Well, actually, the last chapter of the book is called We Are the World,
mm-hmm.
and I really sort of talk about what I like to think about. Its subtitle is Making It in an Expanding Black World and Joining an Unbroken African Culinary Circle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that old church song, May the Circle Be Unbroken.
Yes, indeed.
And I think one of the things that is certainly happening in the 21st century is, in fact, and indeed, the circle is unbroken. That whole notion of fresh ingredients is just, that's sort of the great American anomaly. You know, we are increasingly disassociated from our food. But when I grew up, my grandmother, who lived in the projects in New York City, had a garden plot. And so if we were eating collard greens, they were greens she'd grown. So they were fresh. That was one of the things I was going to say about that southern succotash.
Mm-hmm.
It is an interesting dish because it is a dish that speaks and sings literally, loudly, and joyously of summer at the height of harvest.
Yes, it does.
When you've got the freshest tomatoes, the freshest corn, you know, the freshest okra, it is just an extraordinary dish, and it doesn't require a lot of cooking.
We've got the collard greens.
Because all of those things are just there.
They're there.
But as you go into winter, it can be made of things that have been put up.
Tony's watching
and
me I with have, this fork yeah. covering near my mouth. You mentioned collard greens, and I've got
so
a forkful. Let me get just a mouthful of this, because I want to go. Now, let's see. Collard greens, tell us what's in here, Tony.
Well, the collard greens, a little twist. I made it with the smoked turkey wings. I know Jessica knows, you know. I mean, a few people
our
don't like the...
Our healthier future. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. And that's my goal.
She had ham hock in her recipe, I think, right?
Sure did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, bacon. Mm-hmm. Bacon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep.
It tastes great. You get the same effect.
Oh, yeah. Either way, it's
you
good.
You get the same effect. The only thing is that if you're starting to talk about
delicious.
The evils of the nitrates and the nitrites, you really haven't switched much.
Yeah, the salt is still going
in the
on
smoking,
there. How do collard greens become so identified with this cuisine? Is there a direct African connection?
Well, see, now this is the little thing that I love. Collard greens are not African.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting a sort of incensed phone call from the late and absolutely wonderful American culinary historian Karen Hess, who called me. I think it was my first not so much knowledge, but my first real phone contact with her. She said, Jessica, I can't believe that you wrote that collard greens were African. They are not.
Perish the thought.
Cringe, cringe, cringe. collard is a corruption of colewort, C-O-L-E-W-O-R-T.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Colewort is any non-heading cabbage. Collard greens are Northern European greens. The Africanism, if you will, in the collard greens as we know them, those that are cooked long, low, and slow,
mm-hmm.
those collard greens are Africanized by the consumption of the pot liquor.
Meaning?
That liquid.
Mm-hmm.
That liquid, spelled
mm-hmm.
L-I-K-K-E-R. Please,
yep.
none of that
yep.
fancy L-I-Q-U-O-R
right,
stuff. L-I-K-K-E-R,
right.
that pot liquor that is inevitably and invariably sopped with
mm-hmm.
the cornbread,
mm-hmm.
that's Africa in that dish.
So it's the broth
it's
in the dish.
It's that
soupy stew.
It's that broth. It's the liquid, of course, in which the greens were cooked, and we now know that's where all the vitamins are.
We'll take it. You talk about your grandmother, Grandma Harris, that she maybe not the biggest cook ever, but had her beaten biscuits, and you say she could put a hurtin' on a mess of greens.
Well, yeah.
Now, what does that mean exactly? Is that the great pot liquor?
To put a hurtin' on something.
Well, is that the quality of the pot liquor?
Well, it means that she could cook those things. She put a hurtin' on them. She made them hurt. She cooked them so well.
Tony, what makes a batch of collard greens tremendous or just ordinary? What's the difference?
Like you said,
these are great. These are tremendous. How do you
long,
do that?
Slow. How yeah, you say that statement again, Jessica?
Long, slow. Low, and slow.
Long, low, and slow.
Yeah, my collard greens take up to about 10 hours. You know, I give them a little while, sometimes up to 12 hours. And, again, it's about getting them stems really soft and just making sure there's no al dente to them. And like you said, your broth is very key to how they're going to be seasoned.
And they just about melt in your mouth. Let's go to Tony in Charlottesville, Virginia. Tony, you're on the air with Jessica Harris and Tony Brooks.
Hi, Tom. Great show as always.
Thank you, sir.
I just wanted to comment on titterlings. It's a tradition in my family. We have them every Christmas. I just wanted to figure out if they had them in Africa. We're an African-American family. I don't know if it was just, a slavery thing that we ate during slavery or what the history behind those are.
We'll go right to it. Chitterlings or chitlins, small intestine of the hog. Jessica Harris, how do they show up here?
Okay, they show up in a variety of ways. I'm going to tell a brief story because, you know, I can go on. I think you've figured that out by now.
Okay.
I was invited by some friends, and it was fascinating to hear the gentleman from The Gambia earlier, but some friends of mine from Benin wanted me to witness the preparation of a Beninoise dish called kpete. And so they had organized for a caterer to prepare the dish in front of me so I could watch the whole process. And it was truly a whole process because I sat at the door of a kitchen and the butcher arrived bearing the goat who was going to become kpete. Well, he slaughtered the goat. He flayed the goat. He, eviscerated the goat. And then the lady's assistant, that is to say the woman who was preparing the dish, the assistant took the goat chitlins and washed those things like you'd wash a newborn baby. She scrubbed them.
Yep,
she sure that because
they shine.
You know, that's why people don't eat everybody's
of course,
chitlins.
Right.
It's about cleanliness.
Yep.
You know, it is an intestine.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrapped them into little packets. And she put, you know, sort of tied them into little packages. And those were cooked in the stew of the kpete along with the goat meat. And the portions that had the chitlins in them were more expensive. So I think that we can say that there are African antecedents for eating the entrails.
And that goes right on. Our time grows short. So many callers. Peggy in Mount Vernon, Kentucky. Peggy, you're on the air.
Hello. My story is a little different. I grew up in eastern Kentucky in Floyd County, one county over from Virginia.
All right.
And my father's family was there for generations. And after taking a class and doing some study, it looks to me like my father's family, maybe on both sides, are Melungeons. Now, Melungeons, as I understand it from my studies, are a combination of African-American, escaped slaves possibly, Native American, escaped indentured servants.
And does this cuisine sound familiar with that background, Peggy?
Listen, I grew up on virtually every dish she has talked about. Had no idea they were all tied together in such a way, and I love it, but I will have to say one thing, and that she may shriek at this. My brother's family and my family have become vegetarian. So what we do is we cook what we call vegetarian soul food. We use all these dishes, but instead of pork or whatever, we use olive oil. And trust me,
Ain't that America? Well, that's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Do that.
Please do, Jessica. And while you do, I'm going to get to Tony Brooks' fried chicken. It's right here, and I can't resist any longer. But the vegetarian soul food, what do you say, Jessica?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that we forget is the meat, the amount of meat that we see in this cuisine today is actually post-emancipation. This is... These are the additions, if you will, of prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and do your
I'm fine, I'm thinking
it must be fabulous.
it is fabulous. But you're right. There wouldn't have been meat, certainly, all over the place in the slave quarters.
It was a seasoner. It was a little seasoning piece of meat. It was almost a grace note if you had it. So the traditional African-American diet was largely vegetarian. In fact, not only are there my long, low, and slow collard green recipes in the book, but there is a stir-fried Brazilian collard green recipe, stir-fried with onions and garlic, and served with a hot sauce, and no meat at all.
And what do you say?
Quick cooking.
What do you say to the president's admonition we heard earlier when he was enjoying some wonderful southern food? You know, don't tell Michelle, talking about the cholesterol. Is that the answer to that concern on some of this cuisine? Just lean more toward the vegetable part? Don't have all the full parade all the time?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, being mindful of the fact that this was a working person's cuisine. It was a cuisine developed for people who did hard manual labor, and hard manual labor for hours upon hours upon hours upon hours upon hours.
They would work off that food.
They would work off that food. They didn't get up in the morning and have, you know, a traditional Southern breakfast and then slip into their Mercedes with their ever-widening backside. You know, they got up, plowed the back 40, and then sat down to that breakfast.
You know, I wish we had another hour for this. We do not, but it has been so much fun. Tony Brooks with the Coast Cafe. This has been just a tremendous treat. Online, people are all jealous of me, and you should be out there. Tony, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you again, Tom.
Tony Brooks of the Coast Cafe. Jessica Harris' new book is High on the Hog. Jessica, let's do another hour. Sometime. Thank you very
Anytime
much for being.
You want to.
Nice to meet you.
Only if I'm in studio and can
okay,
eat.
Okay, we'll bring you on here. Sweet potato pie from Al Jarreau. This has been wonderful. We're going to chow right on. Thank you so much, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My head lighter than it's ever been. And anyone who's ever had sweet potato pie really don't want again. No, they won't want again. Give me some sweet potato. That's what I need.